This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to start our show talking about how our Main Streets occasionally change when new people show up in town. We're going to talk about the issue of immigration and refugees with a couple of people who are involved in this effort. Shirley Dykeshorn is in studio with me. She is the Vice President of Humanitarian Services for Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota. Shirley, thanks for being with us.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
And we're going to talk about an upcoming conference that Lutheran Social Services puts on. This is Building Bridges. It's coming up the week of April 9th and 10th. That's a Tuesday and Wednesday at the Fargo Holiday Inn. And one of the keynote speakers joins us by phone from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. That's Carrie Lee Skogberg Eastman, and she's an expert on U.S.-Mexico border issues. Thank you for joining us, Carrie.
Thank you.
Well, let's start, first of all, with the conference, Shirley. What's the purpose of it, and who should show up?
We started in 1996 with the first ever Building Bridges Conference, and the focus has always been how we can strengthen partnerships amongst agencies, people who work with refugees and immigrants in our communities, and that includes the whole state and into Minnesota, because we have participants actually even coming from South Dakota for our conference. It's a real positive educational experience. We offer CEUs for educators, social workers.
Continuing education units?
Yeah, that's what it's all about. Mm-hmm. And the caliber of our keynotes and our sessions, we feel, has really added a value to practitioners across our state and in our communities, and that any information that we share and ways that we're educating the broader public is a value.
And Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota has been a refugee resettlement practicer, I guess, since the World War II era.
There have been people that have been escaping war and untenable conditions throughout the world for a long time, and people are coming from various parts of the world that are seeking asylum. And so our work has been with refugee resettlement, but the broader issues of immigration and the needs for people who are escaping terrible conditions in their own locations, they are seeking asylum, and that's really what led us to invite Dr. Skogberg, because there's so much misinformation about what's happening on the southern border, and this is an opportunity to hear from an expert.
Well, you are an expert, Carrie, so you have a doctorate in communication, so help us out here. Why has the U.S.-Mexico border become such a contentious issue?
I think immigration has been a contentious issue throughout the history of the United States. We can look back even prior to the formal establishment of our nation and see political groups forming with the premise that we are anti-immigrant in nature. So certainly that's not true of all of those who came to the United States, but there have always been people within the population who were critical of immigrants or suspicious of immigrants coming into this country. And unfortunately, that has been a theme that's woven throughout our history. However, the topic of immigration kind of goes through ebbs and flows in terms of its prominence in the national spotlight. And generally, when the economy is good, when peace is, you know, when things are stable within our country and things are peaceful, in terms of our relationships with other countries, et cetera, we don't hear a lot about immigration, and that kind of goes off the radar. As soon as the economy tanks, just an example most recently would be in 2009 when we saw the recession that started about that time, all of a sudden immigration rises to national prominence again, and we begin to hear more and more about it. And immigrants are often targeted as part of the cause or the source of people's worries or concerns as to their own economic situation or the stability or security of the country. So immigration has always been a topic that has been a concern in this country, for better or for worse. We don't hear about it often when things are going well, but when things become more unstable, then all of a sudden it rises to national prominence again. And what's unique about the past few decades is that starting in probably the early part of 2000s, or especially as we got into 2005, 2010, we began to see this issue pop up on a national scale, and it really hasn't gone away, or we haven't seen that ebb in the attention given to immigration, because it's really remained in a spotlight nationally for a variety of reasons. So that combined with the rise of social media, the fact that we have information coming at us now 24 hours a day, 7 days a week from multiple sources. We have, you know, news media, radio, all types of social media, and people literally are inundated with information from multiple sources. So we really live at a time when it's harder than ever to separate fact from fiction, when there are competing narratives out there about what the nature of immigration is, what it looks like, what the problems are, etc. So it's really important that we sort of become a more media literate society, learn how to evaluate the sources that we consume, look at the sources of the information that we consume and analyze the validity of those sources, and then make up our minds about issues, any contentious issue, but immigration being one of those, based on real facts and real empirical data, rather than basing it on emotional responses or information that comes through sources that may not be verified or be accurate.
Well, then let's get into some of that, because when we talk about this border between the United States and Mexico, oftentimes people confuse who's trying to cross and why. And I don't think that Mexican immigration is particularly an issue right now. It's people who are marching through Mexico from Central America to get to the border, isn't it?
That's correct. That's correct. Prior to the mid-1990s, what we saw in this country was primarily a circular migration cycle, and the primary source of those migrants was Mexico. We saw a lot of working-age individuals, particularly males, who were coming into the United States, and we called them target wage earners. So those individuals would come to the United States, work for a specified period of time, or work to earn a target dollar or peso amount, as you would, and then they would return to Mexico. And this circular pattern was very well documented. It was studied by researchers, and it was easily predictable which months would be the peak months and which months would see fewer migrants crossing or crossing back into Mexico, et cetera. So it was a very predictable cycle. Starting in the mid-1990s, we began to fortify our southern borders through U.S. Border policy. And that included the placement of more boots on the ground, more Border Patrol officials at the primary crossing points, and the building of fences in those areas as well. Basically, what happened is we took the two primary crossing areas where the vast majority of those who came without documentation entered our country, and we put a clamp on them. And as if you can imagine blowing up a balloon and squeezing on one end, the other end inflates. But what we did on the border was to squeeze both ends at the same time. And so the area that inflated was in between. And that's where we saw a rise in undocumented immigration through the southern part of Arizona, northern Sonora, Mexico, into southern Arizona. So we began to see a change in the demographics of immigration at that point. And over the past 10 years, roughly, we've seen that change further from Mexican migrants to Central American migrants, and no longer are we seeing the huge influx of or a large influx of individuals coming from Mexico to work, but now we're seeing more family units coming from the Northern Triangle of Central America, which includes Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, and those family units and children called unaccompanied alien children, or UACs, are coming to escape violence and poverty in that part of Central America. So after the economic recession of 2009, the number of Mexicans coming actually dropped, and we saw a greater outflow of unauthorized Mexicans who are in the country going back to Mexico than we saw coming in. But what we have seen is a rise in the number of family units, and unaccompanied children, or children who are not accompanied by a parent, entering in through more of the Texas area along the Rio Grande area of the border, as well as Arizona. and they are coming for different reasons to escape violence and poverty.
Well, I have actually been on that interstate that goes through Arizona and goes into Texas, and there's a huge Border Patrol stop there. The entire interstate is stopped while mm-hmm. the dogs check your cars, and it's a relatively efficient process, but it's clearly an indication of where there is concern about illegal border crossings. But you talk about the type of people who are coming across the border being family units now more so than individuals mm-hmm. looking for some economic opportunity. That points to another issue, because we've got this separation that's been well reported of parents from their children for whatever processing procedure is necessary. And mm-hmm. there is no, like, refugee camp. I think Shirley Dykshoren was talking to me about that before we began this discussion with you. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Why don't we have a place where these people can be together while this takes place?
That's a great question, and it brings up a very, very important point, and something that media don't always get right. When we're discussing the groups who are coming into the United States now or who are seeking refuge in the United States, it's really important that we get the language right so we know who we're talking about. There are basically four groups of people who might enter the United States, the first being migrants, or people who are fluid in their destination and who don't necessarily have intentions of putting down roots, that are going from place to place, perhaps seeking economic opportunities, et cetera.
We are well acquainted with those people here because we've had, for generations, farm workers that have come up here in the summer to assist with things like hoeing sugar beets and things like that.
Exactly. And those are the types of circular migration patterns or circular migrants that we saw prior to the mid-1990s here in this country. Another group would be immigrants who come to the United States with the intention of putting down roots and rebuilding a new life here. So that's a completely separate category with separate push and pull factors that bring them here. A third category would be refugees. And a refugee is someone who is escaping their homeland or fleeing from the place where they live based on fear of persecution because of their race, religion, nationality, membership in a political group, or membership in a social group. So based on one of those five criteria, they feel that they cannot stay in their home because their life is in danger. Refugees are officially designated as such by the United Nations Council, High Council on Refugees. And so to be considered a refugee, you must have gone through this paperwork and the process through the United Nations and had the interviews and background checks, et cetera, to be designated as a refugee. Once you have that designation, you can apply to be resettled in a third country, but it's a very, very small percentage, actually, of the world's refugees that ever are resettled into a third country. So that's the definition of a refugee. But in the Western Hemisphere, we have very, very few refugees because there literally are no refugee camps established anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. They don't have a place to go where they can officially be gathered and, you know, receive this designation from the United Nations. So then we have our fourth category, which is asylum seekers. And asylum seekers are individuals who fit exactly the same criteria as refugees. They've fled based on one of these five criteria of race, religion, nationality, membership in a political or a social group. But they are applying for protection or status from within the borders of a country rather than from outside those borders, where refugees would apply from some other place outside the border of the country that they wish to go to or to be sent elsewhere. Asylum seekers go within the borders of a country and ask for asylum from that point. So really what we're seeing on the southern border right now is a huge surge in asylum seekers, and often they are confused or labeled as illegal immigrants. But when you have a family unit that is going to Border Patrol and asking for asylum, that there's nothing illegal about that process. It's perfectly legal within the boundaries of U.S. law and international law. So they are not illegal immigrants. They are asylum seekers. And that is largely what we're seeing along our southern border now in terms of this demographic shift in those who are seeking to enter.
Well, it sounds to me like the issue here isn't so much this wall or the border structure itself, but the process we have for handling people who want to cross into this country. The ports of entry is often mentioned, but the whole asylum-seeking thing, that must involve some kind of legal process. And are we staffed? Do we have the kind of infrastructure for that procedure?
That's a great question. No, we do not have. We have an infrastructure and we have a process in place, but it isn't nearly enough to be able to deal with the numbers of people that we are seeing. So already before this phenomenon began to occur, there was a backlog of cases in our immigration courts in this country because we just don't have enough judges to efficiently process all the cases on the docket. But in recent years, and particularly since the government shutdown occurred at the end of last year, but even prior to that, we've been seeing more and more people asking to apply for asylum, and thus a greater backlog of cases. If someone seeks asylum in the United States, let's say that a family crosses the border and finds a Border Patrol officer and asks to seek asylum. They say that their life is in danger because of a threat in their home country. That Border Patrol officer then conducts what is called a credible fear interview and does a quick interview of those individuals to determine whether he or she feels that that story is valid, if there truly is a credible fear that is leading them to seek asylum in the United States. If the officer determines that, yes, the story is valid, the family will be processed on a track to seek asylum in the United States, which involves getting a designated court in which they must appear. The court date right now, the backlog is so great that the court date probably wouldn't be for 2 to 3 years before their case is heard. But they are guaranteed the opportunity to stand before a judge then and have their case heard in a court of law. If their story is not deemed to be credible, they most likely are put into deportation proceedings and sent back to wherever they came from. And in some cases, that's a very dangerous proposition because they've fled because their lives are being threatened. So they end up in the same situation that they've just risked their lives to escape.
Shirley, I want to get some response from you here because you're the Vice President of Humanitarian Services for Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota, which does place refugees in our area and has been doing it for these various reasons that Carrie has talked about for a couple of generations now. I can remember when Bosnians were coming to the Fargo-Moorhead area because of the disintegration of Yugoslavia. How many refugees do you try to place in a year? And as I understand it, it's been diminishing a bit, hasn't it?
Yeah, we have an approval for accepting about 300 cases, but the numbers are probably about half of that amount that have actually been able to come and that have been in the pipeline and approved for arrival.
Is that because of what Carrie's talking about here, the processing, or something else?
Well, it has to do with international processing. It has to do with the level of staff and then the series of executive orders that have limited people from certain countries from coming, even though there is an unprecedented worldwide need for refugees to have a place to go. We haven't been able to get those cases approved through our affiliate agency, voluntary agencies that are working on placements.
Well, recently I did an interview about the Mayflower Compact, and I was reminded then that the Mayflower was filled full of, with economic and political refugees of that time. So mm-hmm. It's not a new issue at all.
Right.
How do you take the response of the community in terms of, because it has become a controversy with some people about whether or not North Dakota or Fargo-Moorhead should be receptive to refugee resettlement.
Well, what we do is focus on the facts, the history, the need, the factors that Carrie talked about that determine whether or not a person will have refugee status. We talk about the vetting, the screening, the medical screening, all of the things that they go through. Most of the cases are having to even though they have refugee status and have been approved and screened, they end up having to repeat the process and go through the tests multiple times because of the delays in processing. So But we're focusing on the work because it's important to a lot of these people that need a place to rebuild their lives, and the fact that in our state there are so many people that now call North Dakota home, call Fargo home, that have been very successful, that have been raising their families here and have are doing extremely well, and they're filling jobs in the community that are desperately needed, and we are proud of the work that we've done in our resettlement.
Well, the opponents of this oftentimes refer to things like latent TB, when I was a kid, if you had a Manto test and you tested positive, you had latent TB, but you still played with that kid, and also talking about it being a drain on social services. Can you respond to those kinds of issues?
Well, again, what we've done with all of our partner agencies is continue to have discussions, dialogues. We meet with them. We talk to them if there are concerns and barriers and problems that they are experiencing, and address them. And that's so many of our agencies are supportive of the work when they see such success and integration in our communities. So it's important mission work that we do as an agency, and we're proud to have a long history of doing it.
Carrie, given your research into the U.S.-Mexico border issue and the types of people who are coming to that border nowadays, what's the most important message you could share with the audience at the upcoming Building Bridges Conference in Fargo?
Just really distinguish who it is that we're talking about and understand the push and pull factors and the legal categories that they fit into. It's really important to understand that the process that a refugee goes through to come to the United States, that's a completely separate process from that which asylum seekers go through to come through, and that refugees in particular really go through the gold standard of vetting and interviews in order to be qualified and approved to come to the United States. In fact, there is no group of immigrants that comes to the United States that is more thoroughly vetted than refugees. It's the top of the line in terms of how many agencies interview them, all of the medical tests that they go through. So the concerns about diseases and that type of thing really are ill-founded, because all of these people go through extensive processes of interviews and background checks and fingerprinting and more interviews and more background checks, medical checks and medical testing to make sure that they are fit to enter the United States. So I think seeing them as, understanding that the rhetoric about people just being let into the United States or about there being open borders is in many terms just blatantly false. Refugees absolutely go through a very, very strenuous screening process. It's the most extensive one that we have. Asylum seekers as well are here not illegally. They're here under U.S. law. They're perfectly legal in the process that they're going through. Even at that, a very small percentage, once they stand before a judge, actually is able to receive asylum or is granted asylum, because the burden of proof is so difficult to prove an asylum case, but they have every legal right to be here to present their case before a judge.
I want to thank Carrie Lee Skogberg-Eastman. She's a writer, researcher, and speaker, and she'll be a conference keynote speaker at the upcoming Building Bridges Conference by Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota. Thank you for being with us, Carrie.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
And Shirley Dykeshorn, Vice President of Humanitarian Services for Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota, thank you for being with us as well.
Thanks so much.
More Main Street in a moment, but first, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The House has passed a measure making it easier for a spouse of a military member who has an occupational license from another state to be licensed in North Dakota. As amended by the House Industry, Business, and Labor Committee, the spouse will not have to wait more than 30 days after submitting an application before receiving a permanent or temporary license. Bismarck Republican Representative Vernon Laning told the House the secretaries of the military branches are urging states to adopt reciprocity, and he said this could be a factor in any future base closure rounds.
Our two air bases in North Dakota are a tremendous asset to our state that we certainly want to hang on to.
The measure passed 90-0. It will return to the Senate to see if it agrees with House amendments. The annual debate about school start dates came before a Minnesota Senate committee this week. The legislation would allow individual districts the right to decide if they want to start the school year before Labor Day. The bill sponsor, Senator Carla Nelson, told the Senate Committee on E-12 Finance and Policy that it is a matter of local control. Tony Quilis of Hospitality Minnesota says that a post-Labor Day start is good for the state's tourism industry.
The University of Minnesota, Minnesota Center for Tourism, did a survey a couple of years ago, and keep this in mind, asking should school start before Labor Day, and 75.6 folks that responded to that survey said no.
Senator Susan Kent says she appreciates the challenges facing tourism, but
Minnesotans can adapt and can work on change how they vacation sometimes. I don't think this is going to be the end of people traveling to those parts of the state at that time of year. I imagine as I'm looking at an empty nest that there will be times where I'm like really excited to go on a vacation where there might not be a lot of small children around.
The bill was held over for possible omnibus bill inclusion. A companion bill is moving through the House. And East Grand Forks, Minnesota officials have been meeting almost daily in anticipation of rising floodwaters on the Red Lake and Red Rivers. Mayor Steve Gander says residents will begin to see some signs of the upcoming flood fight soon as planks go into the invisible flood wall. Gander says the greatest impact to local residents this spring will likely be a series of road closures as the water rises. The mayor says thanks to the permanent flood control system, the flood fight is much different than in the past.
It's really amazing to think what a change in a flood fight that's conducted pretty much by our city staff versus closing our schools for 2 weeks, taking our kids out of school, closing our businesses, trying to fight flood with sandbags. This is pretty ridiculous, the quality of flood protection that we have from this flood control system.
East Grand Forks has sandbags available if needed, and residents can receive a max of 250 bags each. The public is responsible for filling and disposing of them and the cost for doing so. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, introducing the North Dakota recipients of the 2019 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2019 Bush Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. When you say you want to be a musician, a writer, or artist of any sort, a lot of people will ask, how are you going to make a living, or what's your real job? It's not easy to make a living as a creative person, but those who do have some advice. Artist Pastor Mudinde has lived and worked in Rwanda, San Francisco, New York, and now North Dakota. He's one of the writers of the Think Global, Act Local column published in Fargo Monthly Magazine. And today he shares this essay, A Cheat Sheet to Perfect Your Hustle.
So you have a side hustle that you want to turn into your main source of income. It's your passion. You talk about it to your friends all day, and sometimes it keeps you up most nights. You have weighed the risks, and you are still determined to soldier on and chase that dream. You decide to follow the burning desire to move down the one path that you truly believe will impact your life in meaningful ways. We are increasingly drawn to success stories. Not just success stories, but those seemingly improbable stories that have truly inspired generations. The world is full of unimaginable accounts of triumphs, and we hold them as examples of how resilience and good old-fashioned hard work can turn your dreams into a success story, your ideas into something tangible and probably the next big thing. But no matter how brilliant your ideas are or how fluffy and cushy your bank account is, chasing your dreams is a risky endeavor, much so that it has become an age-old wonder. There are musicians out there roaming from bar to bar with guitars and loop pedals, artists stuck in their windowless studios, serving coffee in the morning or moonlighting as a bartender. To the budding entrepreneurs and would-be novelists still toiling away in your apartment, can someone really just quit their job and follow their dreams and pull it off? The beauty of life is that no one really knows. And to survive as a creative usually depends on many factors. Nonetheless, here's a cheat sheet of sorts, a list of beliefs and opinions worth exploring as you hustle. Number one, you are not crazy. reject the popular aphorism that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Creative people don't repeat their perilous patterns out of blind compulsion. They do so because this is how they become better. Only after a lot of iterations and subtle transformations do we evolve. In science, repetition is primarily a driving force behind evolution. If you're putting in work and have unusual persistence and rare grit, it's not madness, it's perfection. Number two, produce consistently. If there is a common trait among successful creative, it is that they are not afraid of pulling an all-nighter producing. To consistently and constantly produce art or music or any other product requires a lot of time and work. Your prospective clients are not concentrated in one place. They are usually in a variety of venues and locations. In order to do this, you need to have a strong, large body of work present in multiple locations. Ultimately, the sure way to achieve this is to take the plunge and produce. Number three, be a visionary. A creative person usually sees things that others are not able to imagine. To be a visionary is to create demand of goods and services that customers didn't even know they wanted or had ever imagined. Visionaries pave a path where none existed. However, people don't just fall in love and walk that path. It's the ability to hold on to your vision that brings people around. This is a tremendous challenge, and no one should expect to come through unscathed. Number four, get your affairs in order. To discipline and organize yourself is critical to the success of your hustle, and by far the most challenging. But to be able to make a living from your hustle, you need to roll up your sleeves and get down to the real business. You have to keep track of all the moving parts of your work. This is your time, revenue, and expenses. If you're well organized, you actually have more time to focus on creating. Number five, we need you. Believe it or not, your community needs you. The world needs more innovators, artists, teachers, and people who have a desire to create, build, and grow things. Communities grow and thrive around people like you. If you have an urge to create something, we need to see you putting in work. We need you to hustle like a community depends on you. And finally, don't delay the inevitable. For each success story you've mused about, there are countless other failures. Every creative genius has this compulsion for repetitious betterment of their work. The truth is, nothing will ever imagine fully formed in a flash of inspiration as if you are a goddess. There will be countless iterations that you will try and they will fail. Failure is inevitable. You simply need the courage to test out your ideas, fix the flaws, and do it again. Failure is temporary, and it only becomes permanent when you say so. This is Pasteur Mudende.
You can find out more about Mudende at PasteurMudende.com. That's Pasteur as in the scientist, P-A-S-T-E-U-R, Mudende, M-U-D-E-N-D-E.com. Next on Main Street, we'll meet 2019 Bush Fellowship Award winner Joseph McNeil, a member of the Standing Rock Tribe.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
Shen Yun presents 5,000 Years of Civilization, combining ancient legends with technological innovations, historically authentic costumes, and storytelling. Through classical Chinese dance, Shen Yun shares diverse ethnic and folk traditions, filled with orchestral sound. May 5th at the Chester Fritz Auditorium in Grand Forks. One performance only, tickets at shenyun.com. S-H-E-N-Y-U-N.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Joseph McNeil. He is the president of Standing Rock Development Corporation and a winner of a 2019 Bush Fellowship. Joseph joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, congratulations on this prestigious fellowship. The Bush Fellowship goes out every year. It's a two-year program in this particular case, and there were three North Dakota winners, so good for us, good for the state. And Joseph, tell us what this is going to allow you to do.
Primarily, it's going to allow me to go get my master's, my MBA in business administration with a focus on executive focus. I'll be going to University of Mary here in the accelerated program, so that I'm very excited for. I wouldn't have the time or the finances to do that any other way, so this is really fantastic, and it'll also allow me to travel to go see other Native communities and how they're addressing their financial services needs.
Well, let's talk a bit about that, because I noted in among the goals that you had for this fellowship, there was the idea of a credit union for the Standing Rock Tribe.
Yeah. How this whole thing started off was I had a goal. I'd like to see solar panels power for individuals at the tribe, you know, as a way to reduce your electric costs, to free up money so that you could have wants instead of buy your needs all the time for the state of poverty that a lot of our folks are in. And that really wasn't going to work out. There's not a net metering clause here in North Dakota. That regulation is yet to catch up here with the coal fire industry, and the local, you know, rural electric co-ops have their infrastructure to pay for. So it's really not a favorable atmosphere for that. So my mind went next to, well, if you wanted to do it, you should be able to get a loan. And how are you going to get a loan? Banks haven't been very favorable to folks on trust land.
They and look for a means to pay the loan back. So.
Exactly. So we can't collateralize trust land, or if you live in housing, it's another situation as well, which a large part of our population does. So credit union, it's worked in other tribes. I looked it up pretty quick, and I was on track. So
you're going to be traveling to other Native communities, and there probably are a lot of ideas out there that might be something you could import to Standing Rock, I take it.
Absolutely. There's one in Kyle, South Dakota, Lakota Funds Credit Union, and I think there are roughly 20 other, maybe I'm wrong in that, maybe 40 other credit unions in Native communities throughout the country. It first started off with CDFIs, Community Development Finance Institutes, that aren't necessarily as regulated as a credit union or a bank, but they would provide micro entrepreneurship loans and small business loans in hard-hit communities. Native American communities, it was a designation for that. So that had sparked off in a lot of communities, and then credit unions came to follow that. And there are also Native American-owned banks, large majority of those in Oklahoma. But we have one here in North Dakota State that's Turtle Mountain Bank up in Belcourt, which is Native American-owned. So what the happy medium for us is going to be a credit union, because it's membership-owned, which really plays well with our core beliefs as Lakota people.
Well, so it's capitalized by the members, or is there some other sort of money that can be put in there by the tribe to get it going?
Hopefully the tribe, we can be able to get some money from them to get it going. But the tribe is pretty strapped, has been pretty strapped. After the No Dapple thing went off, you know, getting the casinos back online, generating revenue has been a challenge, and, you know, just getting good feelings back between our neighbors and us. So we're doing pretty good there. And I run a welding shop in Fort Yates with Rock Industries, and I have great relations with a lot of ranchers on and off the reservation. As we're burgeoning that industry, we're making corral panels and gates and anything you need for ranch and ag. So we're constantly working on revitalizing those relationships. And I see that as being stabilized but increasing between the casinos and any other industry that we have at the tribe. So long story short, that's back on the rise.
Okay. Well, pursuing a master's of business administration with a business finance emphasis is going to take a bit of time. Will you have to adjust your current role with the Standing Rock Development Corporation, for that matter with Rock Industries?
Yes. I don't know how, but we're going to get it done.
Okay.
Yeah.
What kinds of businesses offer potential for the tribe? Because diversification is important all across North Dakota. I would think particularly in an area that's been poverty-stricken for a long time, some opportunities, some hope to be put into the community. What do you see in that area?
I think, I mean, naturally ranch and ag falls in line. A lot of our folks, you know, grow up doing ranch and ag work and can find quick work doing that, seasonal work doing that as well. And that's always something there. But technology, we have a lot of kids coming up that are, you know, computer literate, know how to code, and you can import technology and computer software applications anywhere within the country because it travels at the speed of light.
Okay.
You know?
Is entrepreneurship something that needs to be taught to young people, something you want to bring to the educational opportunities for the students at Standing Rock?
I think that's very important for us, and I will be one of the main tenets of the credit union and its concept is to educate throughout elementary, middle, and high school, starting with the basic tenets of currency in elementary, and then by the time you're in high school, we should be having business boot camps and entrepreneurship training. Because in every community, I think no matter if it's the reservation or any rural community, you have your folks who have certain talents, and they either barter or trade or pay, you know, for those with other members in the community. So there's that natural entrepreneurship in every small community in North Dakota, South Dakota, and be able to capitalize on that and develop a business about that and move forward and accrue, gain, and utilize wealth. I think is going to be, for us, a step in another direction, but a great step when other folks see that you can do it, your members, your fellow tribal members see that it's happening, they can do it as well. We can all get it done to some degree.
Well, a good education is foundational here, and I know that in North Dakota there's some concern that some schools in very rural areas are, in some cases, dealing with a less advantageous curriculum because they don't have the teachers to teach a particular thing as well as perhaps a more urban area like a Fargo, a Bismarck, a Grand Forks, a Dickinson, a Minot, you know, Williston, name those cities. So how would you describe the educational opportunity to Standing Rock kids?
That's a good question. Right now, our educational resources are provided by the Bureau of Indian Education through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is a Department of Interior subgrouping. Finance hits every part of life, and it's just like waking up. You have to go to the store. You have to buy gas. You have to do this. You need clothes on your back. So I think from a simple principle like food, water, finance, shelter, it should be a simple transactional type of education to start off with, but as the kids grow and we grow with our understanding of finance, we can move into corporate finance by the time you're done with it and have those types of education and conversations at the tribe. And hopefully we move into that area where, you know, we're talking about computer literacy and being computer adept as well as software and moving into those other conversations of commerce internationally and also nationally. Like I said, that travels at the speed of light. So being prepared for having those conversations throughout a child's education is going to be imperative.
Well, being a kid is tough just about anywhere. But if you're a kid in an area that where there's significant poverty, where there might be significant substance abuse issues, that just adds another layer of difficulty, doesn't it?
It does. And what I see, though, right now we have immersion schools, Lakota immersion language schools, and these kids are going home after coming, you know, after being in school, learning their own language and teaching their parents. So I see that as happening with this. As well with financial literacy, going home and teaching your parents, did you know this? What are we doing with our money? You know, and parents going, hey, what are we doing with our money? My kid knows more than I do right now. Let's step it up. But it'll raise all boats to a degree with the child having interest in that.
So you've got this opportunity that's been given to you by this Bush Fellowship. Aside from doing some traveling to other Native communities and pursuing an MBA, which is a pretty big goal, what else do you want to do with the time and the money that will be available to you through the fellowship?
Just stay busy.
It doesn't sound like it's going to be hard.
No, between everything I'm doing now, just time management, getting the MBA done, doing the traveling, and making sure that all these goals are attended to, and focus on my 1-2-3s of raising capital for a credit union, but establishing within the tribe the construct, the legal construct, that the credit union will be able to be started, sustained, and protected with reciprocity, with the state and with all the states, so that we're NC National Credit Union, ready to go, and have everything prepared so that when we start looking for capitalization, we should be able to light that off and have adequate staff, but professional staff to run it securely.
And you bounced the idea off tribal leaders, I take it?
Oh, yeah.
And the reception is
good.
How would you describe it? Good.
It's
okay.
Good. We're always looking to develop economically, and we had a tribal council meeting yesterday with our entities. I being one of them, propane, telecom, casinos, and my discussion was with them is that we need to become more proactive looking at a credit union, but also looking at our laws and how we're going to be developing instead of reactive, basing on things that might have fallen into our lap. Let's go look for opportunity instead.
Bismarck State College is looking at becoming a polytechnic university, offering four-year degrees that can be applied to industries that are currently in the state, one of those being the oil and gas industry. Is that something that's Standing Rock? I know the DAPL thing is in the background and is in the past now. Is that something Standing Rock should be looking at?
Well, as a government, we have made motion through the council to resist drilling within our borders. It's not something that we're ready to do yet, and with our valuation and how we value the land and the resources that are on it, and also the negative consequences that brings, either that be man camp or water pollution and destruction of the earth. But the fracking and the fracking water is going to be a big deal, because we may have oil as far as the Three Forks formation goes, mm-hmm. that reaches down into Standing Rock.
Yeah.
But water is going to be a big issue. Trucking it, a lot of strangers coming into Standing Rock, and the whole issue with the man camps and missing and murdered people, whether they be indigenous or non-indigenous, has also been a larger issue that I know that my wife and I have been addressing, but my wife in particular. And we looked at all those issues and said, is that something that we want for our people here at Standing Rock, even though we have a large issue of poverty to deal with? And our council at the time said no.
So standing by those principles, and of course, the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara, mm-hmm. The three affiliated tribes have gone the other way. So.
Yes, they have, and good on them. They're dealing with the positives and negatives of that, and they're able to provide their people with a large set of resources, even here in Bismarck, where they have wellness centers and satellite offices to help with loans and whatnot for their folks, which is a great opportunity for them. But us in our location, we're not ready to do that, and I don't know if that is. In some ways, some people would say we're not taking advantage of our resources, but we're also maintaining the integrity of our land and everything that lies therein.
Joseph McNeil is a winner of a 2019 Bush Fellowship. Congratulations, and thank you very much for being with us today, Joseph.
Always appreciate the time with you. Thank you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Tiny desk. That's it?
Well, and some musical talent.
And a camera. And a YouTube account.
Announcing the 2019 Tiny Desk Contest.
Are we having a good time so far?
Film yourself solo or your band in front of the tiny desk of your choice and perform an original song.
We are taking the Vegas from New Orleans.
Then upload your video onto YouTube between now and midnight, April 14th. Have something cool and interesting to share, because no big deal or anything, you'll be judged by a panel that includes Jason Isbell, Ledisi, and Lucy Dacus.
Oh my God, I did.
decorated with big hair and a tiny desk. I want a tiny desk.
Winners will be flown to D.C. to perform in front of NPR's iconic Tiny Desk and get to go on tour with NPR Music.
Worry, musicians, this could be your big break.
Just think of the Tiny Desk alums.
Tank and the Bangas, Galen Lee, Naya Izumi, Fantastic Negrito.
Hey, didn't you win a couple of Grammys?
Yes.
I want to thank Bob Boylan and the NPR Tiny Desk community because I wouldn't be here without them.
And I love you.
So practice, 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 and get your original song in by April 14th.
No stairway. Denied.
Complete contest rules at tinydeskcontest.npr.org.
Good luck!
This is Dakota Datebook for March 27th. Around this time in 1945, things were heating up for North Dakota Insurance Commissioner Oscar Erickson. The State House had adopted a resolution for articles of impeachment for Erickson, and his Senate trial was scheduled for May. Erickson was an early member of the Nonpartisan League. He served 6 terms in the legislature, first as a representative, then as a senator. Erickson also chaired the North Dakota Republican Party for 4 years when Wild Bill Langer was governor. It was in 1936 that Erickson was elected as state insurance commissioner. An interim legislative committee had reported corruption in the insurance department in February, leading to allegations that Erickson had received kickbacks from insurance agents. He was charged on several counts for corruption and malfeasance in office. The Senate trial in May lasted about 3 weeks. Insurance department employees and insurance agents were among those testifying. Erickson himself took the stand and denied the accusations. Former Governor George Schaefer helped prosecute the case and rebutted Erickson's denial during final arguments, saying, "Undoubtedly, for the record, here is one of the most sordid examples of maladministration in the history of North Dakota." None of the charges against Erickson secured the 2/3 vote needed for the Senate to convict, though one was only 3 votes short. The Senate adjourned, sine die, after the second impeachment trial in North Dakota history, the first being Governor Bill Langer. Insurance Commissioner Oscar Erickson was restored to office, but he died only 2 months later when recovering from gallbladder surgery. He was 61. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Under 13 minutes after takeoff, this new Boeing 737 MAX 8 plunged into the Java Sea.
The Lion Air crash in Indonesia last fall and the Ethiopian air crash this month were disturbingly similar. So why did both planes go down?
These pilots had no idea about it. It was like they were fighting a ghost.
One family's loss and their demand for answers on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, the new NDSU Chali Institute for Global Innovation and Growth will add faculty positions in trade and innovation and economics. On Thursday, we'll learn more from Business Dean Scott Boulier and NDSU Foundation President John Glover. Sue Balcom will join us for another Main Street Eats to talk about starting seeds and transplanting. And we'll share our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.